Time set for argument in case number 87613, Schools Over Stadiums et al. Versus Danny Thompson et al. As you saw in the order setting the argument, we are trying a new thing this month for our arguments, the new thing being giving an extra 2 minutes per side, and that 2 minutes is an initial 2 minutes uninterrupted when each side gets up to argue. So you get 17 minutes each, the first 2 minutes being uninterrupted. With that, counsel, why don't you come on up and let me know if you would like to reserve any time for rebuttal.
Good afternoon, Your Honor. I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal. This is Frank Flaherty on behalf of the appellants.
Okay, and so when it does get down to the 3 minute mark, the yellow light will come on and there'll be a tone, but the clock keeps running ultimately down to zero.
Gotcha.
Okay.
May I proceed?
Yes, please.
Good afternoon, and may it please the court. SOS PAC and the other appellants would like to start by thanking the court for expediting their appeal. However, now there's only 78 days left before SOS PAC has to obtain signatures from 25,000 plus voters in each of Nevada's four congressional districts for more than 102,000 statewide and submit those to the county clerks and registrar of voters by June 26th. However, the district court order has enjoined the PAC from doing that. Therefore, the appellants respectfully request that this court issue an immediate order reversing the district court and dissolving its injunction. Article 19 of the Constitution must be read as a whole to give effect to and harmonize all of its parts. The district court simply failed to do that in this case. Article 19, Section 1, subsections 1, 2, and 3 clearly empower the people to seek referendum on only part of a statute. The words any statute or resolution or any part thereof appear 6 times in subsections 2 and 3 of Article 19, Section 1. Thus, when Article 19, Section 3 requires that the full text of the measure proposed be included in the referendum, in the context of a case like this, that means the full text of just the part of the statute that's being proposed for referendum. As used in Article 19, Section 3, the word measure is the legislative action or the legislative measure that the proponents are asking the voters to take. Now, respondents argue that SB 1 in its entirety is the measure, but that's just simply not the case. SOS PAC is not seeking to enact the text of SB 1 by way of an initiative, nor is it seeking to repeal the entire text of SB 1 by way of a referendum. SOS PAC is only asking the people to vote on whether part of Section 29 and all of Sections 30 and 41 should be referred to the voters for approval or disapproval. And then along with that, there's some small conforming changes that need to be made in Sections 22, 34, and 46. Regarding the description of effect or the DOE, Article 19, Section 5 only authorizes the legislature to provide procedures to facilitate the operation of Article 19. But the district court's interpretation and application of NRS 295.009 in this case actually hinders the operation of Article 19. In terms of the burden of proof, the party challenging the petition must demonstrate clear invalidity. That burden makes sense because the people's right to legislate by initiative and referendum entails the exercise of a fundamental right that is core political speech. This court has stated that every effort must be made to sustain and preserve the people's constitutional right, which is co-equal, co-extensive, and concurrent with that of the legislature. And the reality in this case is for SOS PAC, it's not supposed to be this hard. Okay, the hard part is supposed to be getting enough signatures to get this thing on the ballot. And then if you clear that hurdle, convincing the voters to disapprove of the referred sections, okay? That's not supposed to be hard at the beginning. I mean, the dictate to the legislature in terms of Article 19, Section 5, is only you can only facilitate the operation of Article 19 I mean, that dictate applies equally to the district court. That's why in Education Initiative PAC, this court observed that the description, in the context of the description of effect, that it has a limited role that is relevant only at the beginning of the process.
Mr. Flaherty, sorry, I'm going to pause you there. Talking about the description of effect. If the proposed referendum were to, I guess if the people vote against the legislation that was passed by the legislature, what would be the effect of that?
The effect of that would be part of Section 29, all of Section 30, all of Section 41 would be removed from SB1, and there'd be some conforming changes in those other sections.
And what would be the effect of that?
Well, the effect of that would be the stadium referendum might not be built. Okay,
because the stadium might not be built.
It might not be built.
And what would be the effect of that?
Well, you only have 200 words, Your Honor, so we can't do a discourse on all the economic consequences of that. But I think...
Does it mention any of them?
The fact that the stadium referendum might not be built, although a potential effect, it's a major potential effect. And I think the voters can understand the consequences that might flow from that in terms of there won't be these construction jobs, there won't be new businesses, there won't be revitalized businesses, whatever the case is, in the vicinity of the stadium district.
But it could still be built, and then the payment obligations would come after, and the county could repay, you know, be repaying the Section 34 bonds. I see what you're saying is it could just be a little bit misleading because it says the stadium may not be built, but it could still be built. And then there would still be an economic impact there, yeah?
Correct.
But what happens if it's I had to read this description. Actually, I just couldn't even understand it. I had to read the changes in the statute to understand what the changes were supposed to be. It just doesn't seem to be in any kind of plain language that a person could understand.
Well, I disagree, Your Honor. The description of effect, it starts out talking about SB1, what it does overall. Mm-hmm. It establishes a process to finance construction of the stadium.
Mr. Flaherty, can you explain to me, the legislature did not pledge the full faith and credit of the state and reserve the right to change parts of Section 29 pledged state taxes and all of Section 30 state credit enhancement.
Okay,
What is that even talking about?
All right, and I'll preface my answer by saying that the question you just posed was not raised in the briefing in district court or in the appellate briefing. So there's nothing in the record that I can point to for you. But what I can tell you is that the reason that is in there is because early on, when SOS PAC had announced that it intended to put a referendum petition together, there was media coverage. And an individual from the Stadium Authority was interviewed and commented on the fact that as far as the authority was concerned, and I'm paraphrasing here, SB1 is in place, we are moving forward, or we are moving forward with contracts, okay? For SOS PAC, that signaled that there could be an impairment of contract issue if it attempted to repeal the entirety of SB1 through referendum. So that language is reflecting certain subsections in Section 29 and Section 30, where the legislature expressly reserved the right to change its mind about the pledge of state taxes and about the credit enhancement.
How would a voter understand that?
Well, a voter has access to the full text of the proposed measure, right?
They need to call you to get the explanation?
Well, you know, the voters look at the text of the referendum itself, and they can see what's struck out. And I suppose any voter has a question about what something means. They might go to other sources at that point. I mean, we can't give them all of that in just 200 words. I mean, and this court has held that we can't get into that level of detail because that would be constitutionally infringing on the Article 19 rights that SOS PAC and others similarly situated have.
I think the struggle that I had is it actually seemed like in some ways this is overly detailed, and then there are pieces of it that seem to be completely missing. Like, why would anyone want to vote for this? I mean, it's not even I don't think it really even states clearly what the objective is.
I disagree, Your Honor. It states that the petition seeks to refer portions of SB1 to a vote of the people. It says right there in the description of effect. And in fact, that was one of the respondents' criticisms. But to me, to the SOS PAC, it's important that the people understand what they're being asked to sign. If you sign this petition, and if we get enough signatures, we're going to refer these sections of SB1 to a vote of the people for approval or disapproval. If it's approved, they stay exactly as is, and they can only be changed by a direct vote of the people. And if they're disapproved, they're removed from SB1, and it's possible that the stadium might not be built. And again, in response to an earlier question, that in itself is a potential effect, a potential major effect. And I think the economic consequences, though not detailed, but there were some significant economic consequence, is fairly obvious to the average voter.
Is it true that, so it describes using up to $380 million of taxpayer money, correct?
Correct.
But that money won't be used unless the county is unable to repay the Section 34 bonds through other sources of funding, including revenue from the stadium itself, right?
Well, as I understand it, the revenues are pledged to pay debt service on the bonds or to service the bonds. My read of the statute is that there is going to be public money spent. We don't know exactly how much, but we do know that at least as with regards to the section you're talking about, it's capped at $380 million. It is a number, I guess in fairness, it is a number between zero and $380 million. And that's why the description of effect says up to, right?
Okay. Well, I just don't know that the taxpayer understands or is being informed that money won't be used unless there's a deficiency to be able to fund the repayment of the bonds through other sources, through other funding sources besides the public funds, right?
Yes, Your Honor. We only have 200 words.
I know. I sympathize right. with you completely, but you know, those are just a couple of the things.
The PAC is not lying to anybody.
No.
When it says up to $380 million of taxpayer money could be spent to build a stadium.
It could be a little misleading. Not lying, of course. I would never say that, but maybe just a little. And I completely sympathize. Having to do something in 200 words is difficult.
Correct.
But you know, I think that maybe the taxpayers would be interested in that fact, as well as the one brought up by my colleague, Justice Kadish.
So, counsel, we have a prior decision. I think it's Education Freedom Pack, if I'm not mistaken, but where we dealt with a case involving a proposed ballot measure that would have taken public money for ultimately to be used for toward private schools. And we found that couldn't go on the ballot because it didn't explain that money is going to come out of otherwise public school money or other public services. Now, in this case, I guess it's a little different because money is being spent and you're trying to get it to, well, maybe money is being spent, it's being pledged. And that wouldn't be the case if the referendum went through. But isn't there the same problem, though, if it's you're not explaining, like, what's the effect if what you want happens?
Well, this case is not like RIP Commerce Tax, the unpublished decision, where the description of effect failed to explain that there'd be a gaping hole in the budget if the Commerce Tax was repealed. You know, this court said in Education Initiative PAC that the district court has to take a holistic approach when you're looking at the description of effect. You can't take a hyper-technical approach. You can't parse the words in the description of effect the same way you would a statute. It's not fair. It's not fair. I know I sound like a broken record when I keep on talking about only 200 words, but that is really a challenge. I mean, the description of effect survived constitutional challenge before this court because it facilitates the operation of Article 19. Okay. It doesn't reduce it's a procedure, but it doesn't reduce speech, right? It doesn't reduce the exercise of this fundamental political right. And a lot of the questions that were posed by the respondents and some of the questions posed here today are really very technical, and they're really getting into the nitty-gritty of SB1, which is 66 pages, which, by the way, cross-references SB1 from 2016, okay? I mean, that's when the Stadium Authority initially got started. So there's really just no way to constitutionally require proponents to do all that in just 200 words. Unless you have more questions for me right now, I'm going to save, it looks like, 2 minutes and 25 seconds. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. I'd like to say at the outset, I would be remiss, even at the risk of losing a few seconds, I wanted to note the tragic events yesterday of our colleague Dennis Prince's office, and remind ourselves that we inhabit an extraordinarily adversarial profession, but that we all maintain an obligation to contribute to its collegiality. Now then, may it please the court, Bradley Schrager for Bravo Schrager, or for the defendants, interveners from Bravo Schrager LLP. The people's right to propose initiatives and referenda pursuant to Article 19 are obviously incredibly important rights. However, they are circumscribed and bound up in a set of reciprocal obligations on the part of proponents to the voting public. And they must observe these assiduously. Now, these procedural obligations exist for the purpose of ensuring that proponents have made a good faith presentation of their petitions when circulating them to prospective signatories. And these all have one important thread in common, which is that they work towards informed decisions by Nevadans about whether to sign or ultimately to support the proposals. In almost all respects, proponents are the masters of their petition. They choose which new laws to propose. They choose which existing laws to amend or which to target through referenda. They're in charge of that. They get to draft the text. They get to frame the eventual political campaign. They are permitted to say essentially anything they want to garner support from the public for their proposals. But in matters of form and procedure, proponents must comply with non-political objective requirements designed to fairly inform Nevadans of the meaning and import of their petition. And those rules include the single subject rule, which this court has treated exhaustively, the description of effect requirement, the handling and formatting of petition documents, the affidavit of the circulator, all of those things. And in a matter of first impression, I think here today, though it's been mentioned before but never explored, the full text requirement of Article 19, Section 3, pursuant to which each referendum petition and initiative petition shall include the full text of the measure proposed. And that phrase is actually original to direct democracy in Nevada from the 1912 amendment. It's been, Article 19 has been amended several times. That is original. And it is a failure of proponents to comply with this requirement that was below and remains here today fatal to the petition filed with the Secretary of State. Now, I don't want to give it short shrift. The description of effect is also similarly deficient, and I will certainly get to those, but I wouldn't mind starting with the first time appellate issue before this court, the matter of first impressions, Article 19, Section 3's full text requirement. SB1 has 46 sections. It's not the shortest legislative act in state history, but it's certainly not the longest. It treats a number of issues. It's a complex and technical legislative package. It has financing for a Major League Baseball stadium in Clark County, a sports and entertainment district. It authorizes the Stadium Authority. It authorizes bonds related to financing, requires the state treasurer to provide credit enhancement. It issues transferable tax credits, and on and on.
Council, do they have to submit the full text, even those portions that are not going to be put forth before the voters?
Yes. Yes, they do.
That's how you interpret?
Yes, and I will walk through exactly why that's true, because appellants here acknowledge that they're not looking to repeal all of SB1.
Right.
They're seeking to repeal, seven discrete sections out of 46. And apart from how that may work with the approval, you know, there's sort of words in individual sentences that may be approved or not approved. So that may or may not function properly later on with the notion that from now on that word or that sentence can only be repealed or amended by the vote of the people. But this piecemeal approach, which is at the heart of what they're doing, means that no matter what happens to this referendum, after Election Day in 2024, some version of SB 1 is going to exist. It's either going to be the version that exists right now, or it's going to be the version with the deletions that the referendum proposes. Some SB 1 is going to survive this. So what they're asking Nevadans to do is choose between two options or two legislative futures for SB 1, either the current form passed by the legislature or the truncated version with their deletions. How are Nevadans expected to make the appropriate choice between those two versions if they aren't provided with the full text of the measure? You know, if you sort of take it to its logical extreme, that in a referendum, all you had to do was show the thing you wanted to delete. That could be a sentence out of a 46-page bill. That could be a word out of a 100-page bill. If you only had to show that word with the strike through, how would Nevadans be able to make the choices that they're asking them to make, which is which future do you want for this particular bill? But by doing it this way, it shows these sections isolated, out of order, out of context. There's no way to discern how these proposed deletions will affect the bill as a whole in the event they are successful. I mean, in some ways, it's a reflection of the problems you all have already enunciated regarding the description of effect, which is, all right, looking through this to a future in which this, and I also, Chief Justice Kadish, I have the same problem with approve or sort of disprove. Will it be yes or no on the ballot? But looking through the fabric to that future, what is it going to look like? What is the meaning? The description of effect fails to get us there, but actually the structure of the petition itself fails to provide Nevadans with that information. And given the presumption that petitions must encourage well-informed decision-making, this is problematic, if not outright misleading. Furthermore, adding to the confusion, and this was also noted by the district court, they have presented their sections out of order, right? They skipped through to SB 1, Section 29, then to 30, then to 41, then back to 22, 32, 34, and 46.
Wanted to talk about the language of the actual constitutional provision. Yeah. So first, in Article 19, Section 1, Sub 1, it contemplates that there can be a referendum petition, that a statute or a part thereof enacted by the legislature be submitted to the vote, right? So it contemplates it can be the whole statute or part of it,
it does,
submitted to a vote. Okay. Then Article 19, Section 3 provides that each referendum petition shall include the full text of the measure proposed.
Yeah.
So it seems to me then the question is, what's the full text requirement is the full text of the measure proposed. And they would argue the measure proposed is to change these four sections. So by putting those four sections in, they're giving the full text of the measure proposed. Yeah. How do you respond to that?
Yeah. They would argue that. They would be incorrect in doing so. And there's really good reason for that. I mean, I'm not sure why we began with an argument about whether or not there was a right to do a referendum on part of a statute. It says that fairly clearly. Now, if you were doing an entire statute, this issue we're talking about wouldn't matter.
Right.
Right? There it would be. The measure proposed would be the thing because it would all be subsumed within one text. We are getting rid of this statute, right? In the context of when a part is being targeted, you have a different situation. You have a situation in which people would need to be informed what this excision is going to do to the law, because the law is still going to stand, right? For example, to take the most extreme example, there's many shall nots in our NRS code, right? If I were to run a referendum on one that was simply to get rid of the not, and now it was a mandatory shall, and all you had to show was the not, that wouldn't go very far to informing Nevadans as to what exactly they were being asked to consider. So that was part of my argument as to why There are two futures for SB 1. So that when you talk about the measure proposed, there's the legislative act, SB 1. There's the referendum, what they want to do to the measure or to the act. The measure proposed is post-referendum SB 1. The things without their proposed deletions. And this is, you know, not only is this, I think, a useful interpretation in the context of a referendum on a particular part, it also jibes with legislation and regulation and the affidavit of the circulators that facilitate Article 19, Section 1 and Section 3. And I want to talk about that for a second, because what Article 19, Section 3 says isn't facilitate the ease of proponents for getting to the ballot, right? What it says is facilitating the process. If it were otherwise, we wouldn't have a single subject requirement. We wouldn't have, we would never police descriptions of fact. We certainly wouldn't have a petitions district thing. That certainly makes it harder. It's not about being harder, it's about being fair to the electorate, because they're not the only players in this process. Also players in this process are the Nevada electorate. And if you're, for example, the petition district's rule demonstrates that if you are going to do this, you need to show some modicum of statewide support. Is it harder to do that? Yes, but in exchange for that, you only have to get 10% of the electorate signatures to put this in front of people. Now, in some ways, a referendum is a more powerful legislative tool than initiatives, because initiatives, you know, they go to the legislature, they can have alternatives, they can be withdrawn in certain ways. There's a long process, and there's statutes, and 3 years later you can change them. A referendum is of a slightly different character, an extraordinary character, in which if there's approval of the statute, it becomes essentially a super statute. It's not quite a constitutional provision, because it doesn't merit that sort of interpretive power, but it becomes something else that can only be repealed or amended by a vote of the people. So that's another reason why the observation of the procedural requirements, including the full text requirement, should be heightened when it comes to a referendum. But let's look at the statutes that facilitate, and you don't really even have to say this, because much like the single subject rule or the petition district rule, the legislature could do this on its own. And it says in 295.05756 and in NAC 295.020 sub 2, we require circulators to sign an affidavit under penalty of perjury, swearing that the individuals that they're circulating this to get their signatures had an opportunity before signing to read the full text of the act on which the referendum is demanded. That's slightly different than the language in the Constitution. And proponents want to say, well, that's ultra vires, right? You're going outside. That's essentially unconstitutional for you to require that. But it seems to me to be an important way of interpreting what full text means in this particular context, because it separates the act from the referendum, the act on which the referendum is demanded. It seems to me the wisdom of the legislature is you got to show them the act, and you can show them the things you want to do by way of referendum, but the only way people can understand it is to be given the entirety of the full context.
There's nothing, though, that requires it to be in a particular order, right? Because in some way it could be easier for voters to understand, or at least to see what parts their changes are being recommended, as opposed to having to flip through, you know, 50 pages to find a change that's on page 48.
I mean, I would concede that possibility. What I would say is this. We don't permit any form of argumentation in the description of a fact. There's the place where you're to go to for a good faith, ostensibly objective reading, right? That's not the place for politics, describing the effects, right? You're supposed to do your best to show the ramifications. I think that in some ways, manipulating the order of the sections you're presenting is a form of argumentation, right? If you were free to do it in any order you wanted to, you could manipulate that order in a way that you thought was to your political advantage. language. That's a form of argumentation, I think. And I think that that's not allowed in the description. In fact, it probably shouldn't be allowed, Justice Bell, in the way in which you put together your format. And, you know, it seems to me that this is one of the situations where a bright line rule says, put the whole thing in there. Put it in there, put it in the right order. Everyone gets to see it. That way, this court will never have to go back when someone says, aha, I've got a more egregious misordering that will do me more advantage in the future. I will show even less of the text than I need to in the future because I've been told I don't need to. How much of a burden is it in service of transparency to show your cards? So many other of our statutes and regulations make you do that. This one should do the same.
But what do you do with the situation where they're adding the legislature's passed a statute that will go into a title that's pre-existing? So there are other statutes that are affected by what the legislature is proposing to add. You wouldn't argue in that instance that they have to add in and circulate the rest of the statutes.
No.
Even though without them, the same context argument applies. I mean, you're making a policy-based argument for your reading of this constitutional text.
The distinction that I would draw there, which I think is important, is that, for example, the ranked choice voting amendment from 2 years ago, do you realize how many dozens of statutes need to be overhauled or will be wiped out by that amendment? It's a lot of them. But, you know, if statutes exist side by side, there's an act of judicial construction, judicial interpretation. Has there been an implied repeal? Has there been an express repeal? What are the interactions? That's something for later on. And that's attenuated several steps than saying, here's the bill that I want to attack, right? And in some ways, because this is based on a part of a statute, and because this is a single bill, as opposed to, you know, attacking various statutes that have already been codified, it may be slightly different than it would be another.
And how is a bill that has multiple sections and you want to delete three or four of this multiple sections, How is that entire bill, the measure proposed, any more than the chapter into which a new statute's being codified?
Well, the measure proposed in this context is the post-referendum SB1. So, in essence, the measure proposed, if you were amending a number of statutes, would be that which exists after the amendment. You wouldn't not put all the statutes you are amending into the statute. Its interaction with statutes beyond that is a separate matter for judicial construction.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your
Honor. Roboto?
May I proceed?
Yes.
This court has expressed that the legislative intent of NRS 295.009 is to promote informed decisions, avoid voter confusion. If we were to say that that is the same intent behind Article 19, Section 3's full text requirement, then that would mean that we want to present the petition in a format that helps the voters understand what's being presented to them. Justice Bell's questions are well taken in terms of the number of pages that someone would have to flip through if they were given the full text of SB1. They'd have to turn about 8 pages through SB1 till they got to, if they looked hard enough, a tiny change near the end of Section 22. Then they've got to turn, I think it's another 11 pages till they get to Section 29 and 30. Then they've got to scan through 34 pages till they get to Section 41, which is repealed in its entirety. And hopefully along the way, they didn't miss the conforming changes in 32 and 34. Now, let's suppose that there are actually two petitions out there right now, right? One petition seeks to repeal portions of SB1. Another petition seeks to repeal SB1 in its entirety. But according to the respondents, both of those petitions would have to contain the full text of SB1. How does that prevent voter confusion? How does that promote informed decisions? We're just burying people who might sign this petition with a ream of paper, 66 pages.
But right? How do you define measure proposed in the Constitution?
It's the legislative act. It's the legislative measure, you know.
Okay, so you agree with him that the full that the measure proposed is the full SB 1?
No, I don't.
Okay.
I don't, because
so
we are not.
How do you define the measure proposed?
All right, so if the full text is required, but not complete context, there's something in between, right? Okay. And it's a judgment call. And this court in the commerce tax case said that the petition as presented overall, it was sufficiently clear to the potential signers what they were being asked to sign, what would happen if this thing went through.
Mr. Flaherty, if SB 1 is a car, don't the voters have to get the whole thing to understand how many wheels you're taking off?
No, because we're going to tell them about the car. We're going to say, hey, this is a car. You know, I guess it's got four wheels. It gets, you know, you give them some information. We're going to remove the back windshield from the car, or we're going to take off the side view mirrors. I mean, you tell them a little bit about what the car is, and then you tell them what you're going to do to the car. That's the proposed measure.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you all.
Appreciate the arguments today. This matter will stand submitted and will be in recess until the next call of the court.
Thank you.